Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Hey, it's Cindy Howes and Lizzie Noh from the podcast Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians.
Basic Folk is truly changing the game with our well-researched deep dives that aim to empower the listener while fostering the folk community.
I basically am writing worship music for youth group rejects.
Maternal regrets and maternal guilt are universal.
I try to make things that are beautiful and that are made with like a purity of intention.
You can listen to Basic Folk on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or at basicfolk.com.
Thompson Guitars makes handcrafted instruments in Oregon. Their guitars are built with select tone woods, including Brazilian rosewood. Go to pktguitars.com for more information about their different models and appointments available from their custom shop.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Heart, a podcast about bluegrass. Welcome to the show. Things are rolling along here on Toy Heart. It's nice to be back after a couple of weeks. When we were coming up with the list of guests for season two, I mean, I think this guy was on the list of guests for season one, and we just couldn't make it work scheduling-wise. So we knew we really wanted to talk to him because Tim O'Brien is a really big figure in the development of like the second generation of bluegrass, which is meaningful because these are people who grew up listening to Bill Monroe and Stanley Brothers and Flatt and Scruggs, but also the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin. And, you know, it was the generation that was often, taken in more than just corn whiskey. I was excited to talk to Tim O'Brien because to my generation of musicians, he's probably as influential as Bill or Jimmy Martin in inspiring us to play. Powerful singing, powerful playing, all heart, and doing things his own way, no matter what. Tim is one of the founding members of one of the greatest bluegrass bands in history, Hot Rise, who were inducted into the Bluegrass Hall of Fame. And in his solo work, he has won a number of Grammys, but he's a kind, down-to-earth guy. And I was grateful he said yes to answering a few questions about his life and what influenced him along the way. If you're not already subscribed to this podcast, please do so. Here's my conversation with Tim O'Brien. Tim, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's nice. I'm kind of here just to talk to you about bluegrass music, which is really exciting. You know, I know you've done a lot of other genres of music, and I've been a fan of yours for a really long time, but it's nice to talk to you sort of about this sort of one thing, as opposed to have to talk about everything. So I suppose I should start in the most basic way to start, which is, what is the earliest memory you have of music at all? Like when you close your eyes and think about the first time you sort of can remember music, what is it?
I think the first thing it was, that, you know, tangible memory was, I got a crystal radio set, you know, and used the radiator, sort of obsolete radiator that wasn't hooked up to anything as an antenna. You'd hook a little clip on, you know, alligator clip onto it. And then I had a little single earphone and I'd listen to that between lights out and bedtime, lights out and sleep. And it was Chubby Checker. Every minute, every hour was Chubby Checker doing the twist on the local stations, because it was 1960. It must have been 1960 or 61. Come on, baby. Let's do the twist. Come on, baby. So come on, baby, do the twist.
And did you dig it? Like, did you have an affinity for it right away?
Yeah, I think I was already into music. My mom told me that I wanted to be like, I had a toy uke apparently before that, and I sort of told her I wanted to be like Elvis. I mean, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
But I also had cowboy outfits and stuff, and I wanted to be a cowboy, and I like music. And anyway, so, but the first time I remember hearing it was that.
That was in Wheeling, West Virginia?
Yeah, Wheeling, West Virginia.
And so in Newfoundland, where I'm from, Wheeling is a big deal because that's where we heard country music from. Like,
yeah,
that was the army.
Absolutely.
We're in St. John's. So we would get what was the name of the show? Like the Jamboree or?
Yeah. WWVA Jamboree. And, I was, actually I have a cast picture from that year, 1960, and it's got Jimmy Martin and the Sunny Mountain Boys with J.D. Crow and Paul Williams. And it's got, Hilo Brown and his band, which includes Norman Blake and Melvin Goins and, a guy named Billy Edwards, who's a fantastic musician. And then, Bob and Sonny Osborne are in the picture. I mean, they're all cast members for that whole year. I missed all that because I was too young. I didn't know anything what it was. But yeah, WWVA, when I started becoming a musician and playing, I realized, oh, I could go hear the pros down here on Saturday night, and I could pay $2.50 and get in a balcony seat and watch the shows. It was a great education.
Now for the next 15 minutes, let's welcome the Family Brothers to WWVA.
What a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the what a blessedness, what a joyous night, leaning on the everlasting.
Who did you see? Who did you see at those shows?
Well, I mean, I saw the local, they usually had a house band and guests. So there were local people like Darnell Miller.
My grandma, she was happy, though she only knew one man.
Junior Norman, who was like an African-American country singer, kind of like a Charlie Pride. He was fantastic, sang Hank Williams stuff.
I couldn't keep from crying, sad eyes were looking at me.
But then they would have the guests like, Jerry Reed or Jerry Lee Lewis, I saw two or three times. I saw it's a little bit of bluegrass, so the Country Gentleman, Jimmy Martin, Red Allen and his band, his son's band. And then Merle Haggard was a real turning point. But Merle came, and he had just put out the tribute to Bob Wills record, and he was playing fiddle. And I went, man, I'd love to play like that. That sounds cool.
Who was playing fiddle for Merle then?
Well, he was playing it.
Oh,
he had
right,
learned to play
right.
Fiddle. He had taken a crash course in fiddling and played it on stage, and he was great.
Gather round, friends, why hurry?
So hold on. So is this after you, because you started with the guitar, right? And I know that like it was...
Yeah.
Doc Watson.
Yeah.
You heard Doc. And so this is after you heard Doc?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
What was that moment? Because that feels like, you know, Bela talks about that moment of like being a kid and seeing the Beverly Hillbillies and saying like, oh, that's what I want to do. I want to play the banjo. And it feels like everyone has that like that break moment for them for old time country music or bluegrass music, you know?
Yeah.
And the Doc one was kind of yours, right? Like what record was it? Where did you see him?
Well, it wasn't a record. It was on the Pittsburgh public TV station, and they had the Berkeley Folk Festival. And I remember it. The guy led this, you know, sort of walked this guy out on the stage, and he had a harmonica rack and probably a D18 or something. And they kind of, you know, stuck him so he was right by the microphone, and then he started playing, and I just went, what is that? It was like amazing. The flat picking thing, you know, and then he finger picked, and I just, wow. And that was it, man. And
what did he play? Like, what were the tunes he played?
Oh, I don't know what it was. You know, his first records were out. He probably played some Deep River Blues.
Let it rain, let it pour, let it rain a whole lot more, 'cause I got them Deep River Blues.
Let the rain. But, I just watched for him after that. And I remember, you know, my dad waking me up before I had to get up for school one morning and said, damn, Tim, come upstairs. Your buddy's on a Today Show, which is, you know, morning TV our breakfast table. And there he was, Doc Watson, sitting there playing on national TV.
Two things I love about that. One is that your dad referred to Doc Watson as your friend.
Yeah.
and also I love that Doc Watson was on the Today Show.
Yeah, it's fantastic, really, to think about that.
Yeah. All right. So then you get the guitar right away, or is there one in the house? Or
well, I'd already had one. I got into the guitar. My buddies in grade school had sort of Sears and Roebuck guitars, you know, mail order solid body guitars, and they were playing, you know, Peter Gunn theme and you know, Wipeout and stuff. And I learned how to play ba 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 be do 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 on a low string. And I thought, wow, that's pretty easy to do. And I started playing their guitars, and then I was 12, and I got my own little acoustic harmony flat top. And a couple of years later, I got a Harmony Electric. So I was trying to do British invasion stuff and whatever. And then, we went to psychedelia and then to country rock. And that's when I, you know, around 15, I got a fiddle and I tried to make sounds on that to play on some country rock songs. And that was kind of a real stretch. I put it down for a year or two. And then somebody showed me a few things on a mandolin. And then I went from there with the fiddle. It's just funny.
What's the story I heard about, like, when you were a kid, you went to your girlfriend's birthday party, or like your girlfriend's sister's birthday party, and you had to back up a bluegrass player?
Yeah, there was a guy in Wheeling named Roger Bland, and he was a really great five-string player in the Scruggs style. And he was buddies with my girlfriend. I mean, it was probably her 13th birthday or something, you know? So I don't know. She lived about a mile away from our house. I'd walk over there. But anyway, they had a birthday party, and they had this guy come to the party and play. He was friends with her dad. And Roger played the guitar. He played the banjo, and then he played some guitar. And I said, well, can I play some guitar with you? And he said, yeah, sure. And then I didn't play with a flat pick. I only knew how to use fingers. And he said, well, you know, you need to learn how to go dum ba dum da. And I said, what's that? He says, well, that's the flat run. And I didn't understand, but I stayed in touch with that guy, and I ended up playing a few gigs with him now and again. And it was really bizarre kind of culture clash, because he was, I don't know, he was really, he was a really bad alcoholic for one thing.
Oh.
There was probably one gig. And it was in a bar, and it wasn't really a gig. It was like a happy hour where he went to drink and I played guitar behind him. But that was like a wake up call in some ways. Like, here's a brilliant musician, but he's got some problems. And before we even left, I went to pick him up at his parents' house in South Wheeling. And first thing he did was, before we left, is he drank pretty much a tumbler full of vodka.
Oh my God.
Just kind of gulped it down, and then we went to the bar.
It's a good lesson in sort of the hard living that can come with the music.
Yeah, no kidding. And then he died, you know, he basically drank himself to death. So it was, but man, he could play. And I saw at another event, like a barbecue that the same family put on one time, a couple of years later, I think maybe a year or two later, had a real bluegrass band. They had a mandolin player and a guitar and bass. I'd never seen a mandolin before. This guy Bud Smith from up in Pittsburgh played, and I said, man, that's really cool. And I got interested in that.
And then what? And then are you like a duck to water? Like, are you putting in hours on bluegrass music? Like, are you listening to the Monroe recordings and the Flat Scruggs and all that?
Well, I was listening to Doc Watson a lot. And then I was listening to, I guess I got aware of Newgrass Revival. But I was into the, you know, the picking. And I remember it wasn't so much Bill Monroe. It took a while for Bill Monroe to come around. I remember listening. Actually, I went out to, with my buddies, I was playing some lead guitar with these guys. I sat in with this band. I was probably 17 or something, or 18. And we went out to their car and smoked some weed. Yeah. And they put on this tape of Bill Monroe. And I don't know what song it was. And there was a vocal. I said, well, who's singing? They all laughed at me. That was Bill Monroe singing. I figured maybe he's a fiddle player, you know, because it was all fiddle. It was real fiddle music. It might have been the Uncle Penn record with Going Up Caney or something that has a little vocal part to it.
So when you went to college then, where'd you go to college?
I went to Colby College in Maine for a year.
And were you playing bluegrass there?
Well, I was trying to, yeah. And, you know, playing stuff by the band and James Taylor and that kind of stuff too.
Were there bluegrass bands coming through the college or anything like that?
Well, yeah, we had, they had Joe Val and his band. They had Don Stover and his band. They were both kind of based in Boston at the time. So they came up and played there at the sort of Colby College coffee house in the student union. And then there was a band from there, the Northern Valley Boys, and they still kind of exist in a way up there. And their fiddler, when I guess, towards the end of the year, the second semester, their fiddle player had moved away. And so they drafted me to play guitar with them, lead guitar. So they had two guitars, mandolin, I don't know what they had, banjo. They probably had banjo, guitar, two guitars, bass. Maybe they had a mandolin somewhere. But so I started playing the guitar with them. And then I came back for the next semester in the fall, and the fiddler was back, and they didn't need me anymore. And I quit school after a week.
All of a sudden, you're not in the bluegrass band. You don't need to be in school anymore.
Yeah, it was like I had to read Beowulf, and I was like, I was trying to be a, you know, literature scholar or something. And I said, this sucks. And I'm not in a band anymore. And I'm getting out of here.
Hey, did you know you could sing at this point?
Yeah, I knew I could sing, but I wasn't pushing that out. My sister and I sang, you know, in high school. And we did little gigs, you know, community centers, weddings and this and that. And, you know, school shows. So I knew, I liked singing, but she was the one who sang more. She was like applying herself and studying voice. And I was just trying to, I was following her lead a lot of times. I mean, on the songs that she wanted to sing. And yeah.
So you leave college. You don't want to read Beowulf. You say, I'm not doing that. I want to play music anyway. Or like, you knew you wanted to play some music.
Yeah.
And where do you go?
That's what I was spending all my time doing. And so I moved back to Wheeling for a while, and then I got a job and saved up money to buy a car. I think I played some gigs with that same bluegrass band that I had played with in Wheeling, and then I had worked in a summer camp in Wyoming three seasons, and some of those counselors from the summer before were going to spend the winter in Jackson Hole, so I thought, well, maybe I'll go out there and I can work in the, you know, I could play après ski gigs at the ski resort there. I love to ski, and I love the West and the mountains and stuff from working out there. So I went out there and spent the winter there, and then had a big hitchhiking trip to California and to Colorado. So people that I met in West Virginia who lived in Boulder invited me to visit, and they basically made a blanket offer. Come live in Boulder, work in the music store that one of us owns and operates, and the other guy, the banjo player guy, works here repairing stuff, teaching lessons. You can teach lessons, work the cash register, maybe you can play in our band. So I did that. That was like fall of 74.
What band is that? What band was that called?
That was called Town and Country Review.
And was there Colorado bluegrass at this point? Was there any?
There was a scene, and there was by that time, I think they had started the Colorado Rocky Mountain Bluegrass Festival, which eventually became Rocky Grass later. And it was a Bill Monroe festival that his talent agency booked. So they had the real traditional acts. I don't think Town and Country got to play there. They would be a local band, and there were enough local bands that got the gigs instead of them.
So when does Hot Rise happen? Does Pete comes to Colorado? Cause I thought Dr. Banjo was like a fun marketing name.
Oh yeah.
But he was a doctor.
He's a PhD. Yeah. He has a doctorate in sociology. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so he moves from Pete Wernick. He moves from Ithaca, New York. Down to Colorado.
Right. His wife, he's newly married. His wife was from Denver, and he spent the summer. I don't know what year it was. Maybe the summer of 75 out there, and then they came about 6 months later and moved out. He and Nandi, his wife Nandi, moved out there, and they had a band. He had a band with Charles Sawtelle and a guy named Warren Kennison, and those were sort of early Colorado bluegrass stalwarts. And their band was called the Rambling Drifters, and they had a four-piece mandolin, guitar, bass, and banjo. And I was a guest fiddle player many times with them. And then in 77, summer of 77, he made a record, a solo record, which I sang and played on. And I made a solo record, which he played on. And Charles played on as well. Charles played on both those records too. So that, and then I moved to Minnesota for a while, and then I was kind of wondering whether I liked it there. And I got a call from Pete, and he said, "Let's start a band, and we'll promote our records, which are just about to come out." So January '78, I move out there.
The band serves the purpose of marketing or like selling the solo records that you had just made.
Yeah, we play a few gigs and sell a few LPs off, you know, on the card table, or you know, the card table offside of the stage, and see what happens.
Right, because it sounds to me like at this point, and I mean this in the most respectful way, like it sounds to me like you're just kind of gigging. You're kind of
just
like
a sketch.
You know,
I mean, it's a sketch. You're looking for whatever you can do. I just wanted to play however I played. You know, at the end in Jackson Hole, I was strolling around in a restaurant playing guitar. And as my friends chuckled and called me Strolling, here comes Strolling Tim. And I said, well, that's kind of weird, but I did anything I could do.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah.
But there was no, I'm going to start a band. We're going to make it. We're going to hit that festival circuit. Like there wasn't pre Hot Rise. There wasn't sort of that thing.
No, I didn't understand that. You know, when I was soon after I got to Colorado and I was playing with Town and Country, I met this guy, Dan Sadowski, who was kind of a great ragtime finger pick guitar player. And he had started this band, the Ophelia Swing Band. And I don't know why they called it the Ophelia Swing Band.
Chicken, light fried chicken, barbecue chicken. Won't you send it down the line?
Everybody knows about chicken. Chicken's a popular word, but you can call it what you want. Get it into the pot. A chicken ain't nothing but a bird. Well, may not be tops in your taste buds.
But anyway,
after Stompied the band, maybe?
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
But he and I struck up a friendship, and I ended up playing with them, and I quit the Town and Country, and I ended up for 3 years, pretty much, I ended up playing swing music with him on the mandolin. I didn't have a mandolin, and a couple of years into it, I got one. So I was playing mandolin and guitar and fiddle. There was another fiddle player. You know, I was learning a lot of music, woodshedding a lot. I was studying with a guitarist in Denver named Dale Bruning, who's still a friend and a mentor. And then I moved away and then moved back to start up Hot Rise.
Was the mandolin you got when you got to play that band? Is that the same one? Is that the Nugget, like the A style mandolin?
Yeah, that original Nugget A model. Yeah, that thing was made in 1970. I think he finished it in 1976, and that I still have that. I play a different one now. That's kind of a copy of that on the road. But I still play it, you know, when I don't have to plug in, I play that one.
Were there a lot of A mandolin players back, A style mandolin players back? I know we're getting into the weeds here, but like Buzz Busby, I guess. And I'm trying to think of some like, but it wasn't as, I mean, I know Jesse McReynolds maybe for a little while played the A style mandolin. Like, I think that the thing the F style mandolin, right?
Well, the thing was that I think generally there were a zillion Gibson A models made in the teens and 20s. There are very few F5s, and the ones that they made later after the 30s were not, they kind of went way down in quality. So it was really hard to find a good one. I was just talking to Norman Blake a couple of weeks ago, and he said, I went 1959 or 60 is when I first saw an F model mandolin because Bobby Osborne was playing with the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers, you know, and that was his first look at one. So they were kind of rare. So, you know, I think there were a lot more A models. And then there was also an F model is a little fancier and they're probably higher quality, maybe a little more workmanship, but you know, they cost more. They should sound better, be better. And maybe they were, but they were fancier looking. So like Jimmy Martin's band, Paul Williams, he always played an F4, I think, you know, an oval hole F model. But the A models, there was only one made in that period that Laura was around. It was a special order. And Sam Bush had a hold of it for a while, and then it got sold. But at some point, the new mandolin makers like Nugget, and there's a guy named Bob Givens, I think, out in Idaho, that made a bunch of A-model, F-hole mandolins. And they became, it's just a lot cheaper to make and buy.
Yeah, I feel like if I saw you with an F mandolin, I'd freak out or something like that. It would be, you know what I mean? Like it'd be singing like a Christmas wreath in July or something like that, you know?
Well, it's a different feel. The way it hangs on the strap is a whole different thing.
Right.
There's a weight on that scroll that makes it kind of neck heavy to me on the F model. So I also happened to get a really good one.
Yeah,
that mandolin was really ended up being kind of a calling card for Nugget. It was the first A model he made, and he'd only made two or three F5s by then.
So Hot Rise, Pete invites you to start Hot Rise. It's you. I'm going to get this wrong. It's you and you on mandolin and fiddle. Yeah. Pete's playing banjo. There's another guitar player.
Yeah, the guy was named Mike Scapp. He's no longer alive, but Mike was our guitar player, and he had played in Ophelia Swing Band too. When I quit,
what was his story?
He was from New Jersey and a great, great instrumentalist. And I mean, he was better than any of us. And it was that was one of the problems. He was very picky. He was very picky about it. And he was also kind of an eccentric guy. So anyway, brilliant and inspirational. But he quit after 3 months, and we had these gigs. Now Charles Sautel played guitar in the Rambling Drifters, and then he. You know, he could play other instruments. So Pete said, well, I like Charles as a guy to hang out with, and he knows about the sound systems and recording and all that stuff. Let's get him to play bass. So we did. And then Scap quit, and Charles used to, you know, switch instruments with Mike, and he'd play a few songs and sing a traditional bluegrass song. So when Mike quit, we went, well, we've got these gigs, you know, next month or two, maybe we can get somebody to fill in. So we called Nick Forster, who there was a sort of a center in Denver, that the Denver Folklore Center was kind of a meeting place. You know, there wasn't an internet, but there was the Folklore Center. You could meet people that were coming through town, kind of, it was just a place to find out what was going on. They had a music store and a music school and a record store. So Nick was working there in a repair shop. And Charles would get a call. He managed the music store. He'd get a call on the phone. They wanted a square dance band for a wedding or something. And he'd put the phone on hold, and he'd ask Nick if he was available because he knew how to call a square dance. And then he'd go over to the music school where Pete and I were teaching. You guys ready? You guys available on such and such a day? And then he'd get back on the phone and say, yeah, we can do it. So that's kind of how it started.
It reminds me of the story I heard about Monroe. Like he was calling when he needed a bass player for a tour and he couldn't get one. He would just like, he would have two phones, a phone in one hand each. And he would say, hi, this is Bill Monroe. Do you own a bass? Do you own a white hat? And if the answer to those two questions was yes, like, do you own a bass? Do you want to, they could go on the road with Bill Monroe.
That's awesome. Did you ever see that video of Carlton Haney and Jimmy Martin? And Carlton starts talking about the Pythagorean theorem.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a classic.
Struggle with that video where, yeah, Carlton Haney and Jimmy Martin are there, and he starts talking about how bluegrass is like the Pythagorean theorem.
Yeah, but at one point he says, you know, I wanted to date Bill Monroe's daughter, Melissa, but Bill Monroe didn't want me to be around. I think he was booking Bill Monroe at that point. He said, he didn't want me to stay away from Melissa. So he said, you come out and play bass with us. So he didn't know anything about it. He just stuck the bass in his. He said, you stand there and you know, pluck it, find a note and pluck it. And He came back the next Saturday night to play the Opry, and he said, "I don't want to do this. This is terrible, driving around in these cars and sleeping, you know, in the back seat. And, you know, I don't want to do this night after night, and I want to be home with Melissa." So he quit that.
Tony Trischka told me a story that I'm sure you know the story, but when he first met Monroe in the back of the Opry, it was during the Patty Hearst era.
Like, oh, wow.
The what's it called? The Symbionese Liberation
Army? Symbionese Liberation Army, yeah.
And she had been kidnapped in Stockholm Syndrome and the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that was in the news at the time. And I guess it was a bit of a cult. I wasn't around, but like it was a bit of a culture war split. Like people were either, you know, what's going on, pro Patty Hearst or anti Patty Hearst. So he had been reading about it in Time magazine, and Monroe auditions Tony. He said, "You know, come on now, you know, I'll audition you to be in the band." So Tony opens up the banjo case, gets the banjo out. And I guess he had been reading Time.
Oh,
so in the bottom of the banjo case, Monroe sees a picture of Patty Hearst on the cover of Time magazine, and he says, "Like, I lost the gig right there."
Wow!
So I love that Patty Hearst messed up Tony Trischka's dream of playing with Monroe.
That Symbionese Liberation Army thing is I've got a convoluted story about my fiddle. I was learning to play the fiddle. I was out there in Jackson Hole woodshedding in between après ski gigs. I couldn't afford to ski. I went out there to ski, but I couldn't afford it because I was on a musician's salary. So I hitchhiked to California. There's a girl that I thought kind of dug me. Well, it turned out she didn't. Anyway, I'm hitchhiking another direction away from where she goes, and I wanted to go to Big Sur. I wanted to see it. And so I got a ride hitchhiking. I had my fiddle in a backpack. The guy took me all the way to Santa Barbara, and it was probably, you know, 1 a.m. and I was asleep. He woke me up, said, "Here, you get out." I got out and I got my backpack, but I forgot the fiddle. He drove away. So I've got, you know, this terrible thing's happened. But the guy had, it was a Volkswagen bus with the middle seat taken out, and it had stacks and stacks of the paper versions of Rolling Stone magazine from early years, and the walls, the inside walls, were papered with articles from the Rolling Stone. So I figured this guy reads the Rolling Stone, and I remembered his name, Jules, first name. So I figured, oh, maybe I can put a classified ad in Rolling Stone and he'll see it. So yeah. I do that. This is March, okay, or February. Yeah, it's late February or early. Well, I got to Berkeley, got to California on that trip the night that Patty Hearst was kidnapped, and I was actually in Berkeley.
Wow.
Okay, so then I go and lose my fiddle. I put the ad in Rolling Stone, and it's, I think, April of that year, 73. The cover has Marvin Gaye on it. And in the back is an ad that says, "Jules, I want my violin, I want my fiddle back. Call this number, collect." And that was my parents' phone number. So for about a month, we got these crank calls. People still play those, or, you know, just weird crank calls, nothing. Then one day I come home and my dad calls from his bedroom window as I'm getting out of the car. He says, "Tim, Jules is on the phone." Well, Jules, it wasn't even his van, it turned out. But when he returned the borrowed VW van, he saw this fiddle case and he didn't know what to do with it. So he put it in his closet. So then in April, he's hitchhiking himself. And in the passenger seat, he's sitting there and there's a Rolling Stone magazine on the seat between him and the driver. And it's that one. He's scrolling through, he sees his name and he calls me. Well, so then my dad, who's a lawyer and works for insurance companies, he got a claim in the meantime of like $250 on the violin as a mysterious disappearance under that category.
Yeah.
So I got a new violin. So my dad said, "Well, we'll have to give back the $250, but the insurance company will arrange the shipping of the violin back to our home in West Virginia." Mm-hmm. Well, they go to do that, but they can't get there because they have cordoned off, the police and the FBI have cordoned off a couple blocks in Los Angeles where Sing Q and the Symbionese Liberation Army are holed up. They ended up burning them out, smoking them out. I think they died in the fire. I'm not sure of exactly the details. In any case, after that got tidied up, then my violin came back.
So hold on, you're...
So anyway, Patty Hearst is part of my story.
Was your fiddle in a closet alongside, like...
Yeah, maybe a block away from where Symbionese Liberation Army was. So, you know, I lost the fiddle like a couple of days after I was pretty close to the event of the kidnapping.
Yeah.
And of course, when I got the violin back, she was still on the lam. She ended up in Pennsylvania, but it's a bizarre thing.
It's a good thing you never told Monroe that story. You never get hired.
No, I never heard of. He would never have listened long enough. Right. He did not trust people very easily. You know, he tests you out. Bill Monroe would test you out, see if you understood him. And he would pull jokes and you'd see if you'd react. And the first time I really met him, Hot Rise was doing the sound at a concert at Colorado Springs. And so we did the sound, set it up, and then we were checking Hot Rise because we were going to open the show. So we're in the middle of the sound check, and here comes Bill Monroe and Kenny Baker, and they sat down in the back of the auditorium and watched us finish our sound check. And at the end of the, you know, I'm singing probably a Bill Monroe song and playing the mandolin. Yeah. And then I tested the fiddle on the vocal mic, and then when the sound check's over. So we go back to the dressing room. Here's Kenny Baker and Bill Monroe and some of the other bluegrass boys. So Bill Monroe, it's such a great honor to meet you. I'm so excited to hear you play tonight. And he said, I like your fiddling. And then he kind of looked at me for a minute, and I didn't know what to say. I said, thanks. And then he walked away. I thought, it took me years to realize, I think my interpretation of it is, Sam Bush would say the same thing. He had no time for Sam Bush when he was playing the mandolin, but if he had his fiddle, he'd say he'd really liked it.
Yeah.
He was the mandolin player. He didn't have any use for me playing a mandolin or singing his parts. But if he thought I could play a fiddle, maybe Kenny could remember my name. Kenny was his kind of address book.
Right.
Kenny would remember who they had heard around the country that might be able to fill in, because they needed people to fill in all the time.
And you never got the call? He never got the call? Hey.
No, I never got a call.
Fiddle or anything like that? No.
No. He did play my mandolin one time, and I have a picture of it somewhere of him playing that A model when his broke, his string broke. And he said, cut's good.
it's interesting to think about Hot Rise that way, because like the way I see it, and I might be wrong here, but the way I see it is that like there was like Newgrass Revival, who by 1980, I guess Bela was in the band. No,
maybe. 82, I think. I just read that, 82.
And so there was Newgrass Revival and Sam doing his thing, pretty progressive, right?
Yeah.
And then there's like the Johnson Mountain Boys, who are pretty traditionalist, you know.
Yeah.
Like they're doing the old shows from the 50s. Eddie's talking, like,
right.
It's the real. And then Hot Rise,
Grass Revival, actually. I mean, really, literally, they were the response to Newgrass Revival and David Grisman and everybody wearing t-shirts and jeans on stage.
Right.
You know, and everybody standing by their individual microphones and never moving.
Yeah, they were a show. I mean, they're a great band. They're
fantastic. Cool. Yeah.
But then, so like, I always thought of Hot Rise as, oh, a pretty progressive band, I think maybe towards more the Sam side of things. But when I was doing research for this, I started thinking to myself, for God's sake, they wore suits and they stood behind one microphone. Mm-hmm. And sure, they had an electric bass, but Doyle Lawson had an electric bass. And I think only in bluegrass can you ask this question. But like when Hot Rise started, how much were you guys thinking about that?
There was a real intention on Pete's part. It was his idea to start the band. He wanted me to be the singer and play the mandolin. But his intention was to play this new kind of music that he sort of envisioned, which he had featured on his solo record that we were just putting out, called Niwot Music, named after his town. And it was sort of featured, the guitar was kind of minor in it, and it was kind of progressive sounding. the kind of jammy, kind of strummy stuff that Andy Statman does. And in fact, Andy played a lot on that record. And Stan Bush, you know, David Grisman, just, you know, mandolin and banjo and some bass. So we were trying to do that, and he said, you know, and he really liked traditional bluegrass, and, you know, Flatten Scruggs, he's just such a Scruggs freak. And I told him, I said, you know, that sounds good. I'd like to do that. But I said, I'd like to do other kinds of music like country or swing and stuff. And I don't know if did you ever try to play dobro? Because a lot of banjo players play dobro. He said, maybe we could do some country stuff that way, break it up. He said, okay, I'll see if I can find one and work on that. So what he got instead was a lap steel. And so we started playing Hank Williams when we started and worked up some sets. We featured some of that stuff where he would play lap steel and we would do a different sound. And when Nick started playing with us, he ended up playing the guitar on that stuff and playing electric. So all of a sudden we said it had a honky-tonk sound with a lap steel and a electric guitar, bass, and rhythm guitar.
And that's the Red Knuckles thing eventually, right?
Yeah, that became Red Knuckles. And it's just that's... So yeah, there was an intention to kind of fuse some different things together.
And it blew up. I mean, that first record, that first Flying Fish record.
I don't know what changed my mind till then. I was
the Nellie Kagan record and the the Blue Knight record. To me, it's like one of the storied, for a genre of music that doesn't actually have a lot of albums when you really think about it. Like it's an album, a very important album and a very well-loved album.
Yeah,
In the same way that the Crow record is, you know?
Yeah, the Crow record, we were kind of at post-Crow record and, you know, Charles was a studio engineer and live sound engineer, and he was really particular about how he recorded things. So I think it sounds, that part of it is the sound and the stereo spectrum that he put on there and stuff, and his ideas about it, that way it sounds. But also, I don't know, we were trying to be traditional and, you know, get some bluegrass work and, you know, centering it on traditional bluegrass. But because of who we are, we just couldn't really play it. I don't mean to compare ourselves to Bob Marley or anything, but Bob Marley was trying to imitate country music, and it came out sounding like, you know, No Woman, No Cry. So we were trying to play traditional, but it just, you know, it sounded different.
When did you know that record kind of blew up?
Well, we went to, there was one gig where we drove, I think we might have driven all the way to the East Coast from Colorado. We had a Cadillac at that time, a 69 Caddy, and a trailer behind it that we painted to sort of match it. And we got all the way for our first gig on a probably 3-week run or something, and it was Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Yeah.
The night before, we arrived the night before when we went to the local college station to do a promo and play a little music. And this guy was watching us through the glass, this student. And after we were done, he went to Charles and said, man, I want to learn how to play that country boy rock and roll. And he played Charles's break back to him. He says, is that right? And Charles went, yeah, I think that sounds right. Of course, Charles wouldn't have been able to play that break himself. He just improvised it and probably pieced it together from two or three takes. So that was an indication. But the next night, when we started playing our first song, we started with Blue Night, and that was the first song on the LP. We started that song and it was a bar, you know, but people went nuts. It was full and they knew it. That was when we figured there was something that was going on. We were in Virginia, you know.
How does that feel in that moment? You know,
it's fantastic. It's fantastic. Maybe you're doing something right and maybe we can make a go of this, because we've been going a couple of years by then.
And then, so you start what? You start, the festivals just start coming in and.
Yeah, I'm starting to. It was slow and it was hard to get there, you know, from Colorado. The first ones we played, the very first festival we played was in New Mexico. And I got to meet up with Country Gazette and stuff and some of the bluegrassers down there. And then there was the Colorado Festival, which I don't think we got booked there. Maybe we got booked there a couple of times early on. But yeah, it was hard to find, you know, you go to Salt Lake and play, but then you'd have to go all the way to California or to Missouri. There was a festival in Missouri we played, and then going to the East Coast was big. I think the first one of those was the Bluegrass Unlimited Festival at Indian Springs. I remember Ben Eldridge from the Sums up to us and says, we all had our suits on. I said, hey, did somebody die? He thought he looked like we're going to a funeral.
Well, because I was thinking about this, is that it's a tightly knit scene of people who played with other people, right? Yeah. You know, like I remember when I talked to Ricky for this thing, like he was telling me how he played with the Country Gentlemen, and then Jerry had played with the Country Gentlemen and also had played in Boone Creek. And then everyone played with Crow, or everyone played with Flatten Scruggs, or everyone played with, or if they didn't, they played in these, you know, these bar bands, but everyone kind of played in the same scene. We ended up starting their own bands. You guys are kind of outside that when you show up in this world, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Pete had a band with folks around Ithaca called Country Cookin', was quite successful.
Yeah, I know that record, yeah.
And they had two good records, and they were kind of pioneers in a way. And then early rounder artists. And then Charles was in a band called Monroe Doctrine, which played all over the country. And they had a lot of good reaction, and they were in the Bluegrass Unlimited, and the Mule Skinner News was another magazine at the time.
Yeah.
But me, I had been in Ophelia Swing Band.
Well, this was all new world for you. This was getting to see Flattens. I mean, you probably got to see the Stanley, not the Stanley Brothers, but you've got.
Yeah, I saw. You know, got to see. Stanley, you know? Yeah, I get to see the sort of the early masters, and I remember we went on to Myrtle Beach and we saw Curly Seckler had revived the Nashville Grass. We met up with Marty Stewart. I'd seen Marty play, so we got to be friends with Marty and. Paul Warren, I think, was there, and it was, you know, it's great.
Did you see Jimmy Martin? I'm always asking people for Jimmy Martin.
Jimmy Martin's stories. I saw Jimmy Martin the first time he came to the Colorado Rocky Mountain Bluegrass Festival. They had changed the management, or what do you call it, the promotion team.
Yeah.
The Monroe talent was no longer in charge of it. And this new guy was a great bluegrass musician himself named David Ferretta. He booked Jimmy Martin. He worked hard to get Jimmy Martin out there. And man, it was an exciting show. The Friday night show was just on fire. I mean, it was, you know, it's like rock and roll, what he does. And I can see why Bill Monroe didn't want him to come to Nashville. Nobody wanted to have to follow him.
Yeah.
Of course, by the second night, he was all hoarse because he just talks all day and night. But anyway, it was great. Yeah, that was my first visit, or my first encounter. I'd seen him on stage. I saw him in Wheeling.
Yeah.
And, you know, two or three songs you'd see on the Jamboree at a time.
I'm a new Jimmy Martin convert. Like my bluegrass was Monroe all the way, right? Hard Monroe. And then of course, you know, I get a bit goth, so I get into the Stanley Brothers. And then, you know, I find my way, and then I'm into more progressive bluegrass. And I think maybe I had just fallen for a bit of the propaganda about Jimmy from those books or those articles that were written about him, you know, drinking and causing trouble at the Opry and stuff like that. But
yeah,
it's unbelievable music.
Now he's very egotistical. But my friend, my mentor, J.D. Hutchison said, well, you know, he is, but he can back it up. He's one of the few that really can back it up. I mean, there really wasn't anybody better than him as a singer or rhythm player. It just, and everybody that came out of his band, over the years were better after playing with him.
Yeah. Crow.
And they come back with this bounce in their playing, and, he really engendered that.
So let's go back to Hot Rise for a second. So Hot Rise is, here's what I was looking through the discography. So Hot Rise is happening, right? Like Hot Rise mm-hmm. is really taken off. IBMA Entertainer of the Year, you know, becomes one of the big seminal bluegrass bands. But I think in 84, you make Hard Luck Blues. Like you're still releasing solo music.
Yeah, I was starting to, I wanted to make a solo. I had made one solo record. Yeah, like the reason, one of the reasons we started Hot Rise, and that was on an obscure label that's out of print and stuff. And then after Hot Rise recorded, I got a deal to make my own solo record. So yeah, I wanted to do that. I wanted to do stuff other than what we were doing, you know.
Yeah, and the no one minded you heading off to do your own thing.
Well, it was. I don't think anybody had. I didn't ask. And, you know, I think Charles, like those guys, Charles and Nick and Pete participated. That was part of the idea to sort of do that. And we could play a few of the songs on stage with Hot Rise.
So when you have that big top 10 hit with Kathy Mattea, Battle Hymn of Love.
Till my death, I will stand by you. There are wars and there are rumors of wars yet to come. Temptations we'll have to walk through. Though others may tremble, I will not run. To my death, I will stand by you.
I mean, no one in bluegrass has mainstream country success, even one song, you know, like Ricky had of course, the country career, but you know, I mean, that's sort of it. I mean, we could probably go through the Osborne Brothers a little bit, Rocky Top and stuff like that, but you get a big hit song here.
Well, it was a good showing. Yeah, that was a good one. Prior to that, she recorded two of my songs, and also she cut one that I had recorded that I didn't write. And so that was, that kind of got me in the door to get a record deal in Nashville, the songwriting success, Walk the Way the Wind Blows, and then Untold Stories. And then I was shopping around. After Hot Rises together for 10 years, I thought, you know, I'm enjoying this, but I'd like to pursue other things a little more aggressively now. And I've got these songs as a calling card, and other people are interested in promoting other songs. And so I got some guys in Nash, I got this guy Ken Levitan to look around for a record deal, and he got some interest at RCA. So I got a deal at RCA, and that came through. It got signed in the middle of 1990.
And there's a record, right? That no one's...
The record didn't come out, yeah.
Do you have it?
Oh, I've got it. I've got a DAT copy of it somewhere.
How is it?
It's good. I mean, what happened with that record was I recorded probably like 18, 19 songs, and then they were going to pare it down to 10. I mean, the original 10, a new guy came in, new A&R guy. Well, no, before that, they said, we need some more tempo songs. They want, you know, they're trying to figure out how it's going to fit.
Yeah.
And so I cut some more songs by other people, and you know, it was a different experience. It was a good experience and a great learning experience, and I think it's a good record. Anyway, gradually as it got pared down to the 10, fewer and fewer of my songs were on it, and then the new A&R guy came in, and he said, told it was all mastered and everything, and he asked the producer, said, "Are you going to put some reverb on it?" And he went, huh? And we all thought it sounded great. So they just ignored it. And then they decided they weren't going to put it out. I could have stayed with RCA and tried to keep making a record that they'd put out. and all those songs would have been tied up. But the other, it didn't look good. And then, so I said, well, let's see if we can shop the tape to someone else, and no one else bit. So I got out of the deal. I got an agreement where I could record the songs again myself. And if they sold really, if the album sold really well, then I'd have to kick in some shares to RCA. And it didn't ever sell.
That sounds hard, man. Like,
that happens a lot.
Yeah.
What happened was, instead of waiting around and kind of playing the game of that, I didn't really want to be in Hot Rise anymore. And so I had sort of said goodbye to it. And I could have stayed and kept doing that and kind of kept at the RCA project and maybe found a way. But instead, I made a record with most of the songs that I wanted to record out of that batch, and maybe a couple more, and toured on that. It came out on Sugar Hills, called Odd Man In.
Working man, were you? He just enjoys the view. It's lonely at the bottom too.
It's different production values, a different, slightly different band. It's not as slick, but a lot of the same songs.
I love this story. Like, I love that you get sort of this massive success with Hot Rise, and then you go to Nashville, and then this big deal happens. I read it as Lyle Lovett was big, and they saw Tim as the new Lyle Lovett, was the thing that I had read when I was doing the...
Well, there was a little window there where they signed Steve Earle, and he's doing pretty well, and they had Nancy Griffith and Lyle Lovett, who didn't work out so much in country music, but they established a career there. And so I was kind of coming in the same door while it was almost... it was just ready to shut.
Yeah, early songwriter Americana-y stuff. You
yeah.
Know? Yeah. Yeah.
And then in the wake of that, you get the Hat guys come in. Randy Travis, but Clint Black.
Yeah.
And then Garth Brooks, just everything's different immediately. Yeah.
And then, but what this tells me is that, like, it's sort of like, because I feel like from then on, I don't need to talk about you in the context of bluegrass for a while, because you sort of do a very interesting thing where you sort of create a sound of your own. You know, like, I feel like I sort of knew, what was that line from the Supreme Court? Like, I couldn't tell you what Tim O'Brien sounded like, but I knew Tim O'Brien when I heard it.
Well, that's good. You know, that was what I was aiming for. The great artists always come up with their own little thing. I mean, and it's partly... you know, it's the product of your strengths and your weaknesses, and you emphasize the strengths and de-emphasize the weakness, and you find a chemistry with other players or whatever it is. And it's trial and error. But I knew I wanted to combine things. I just needed to make it my own, instead of sounding like the first record I made was like one country song, one old time song, one bluegrass song, one blues, one swing. You know, instead of that, I finally got maybe 3-4 records in. I got to something where it does sound like the same thing from track to track, and you know, it's a direction. But it's quite simple, really. It's just whatever I like to sing, and then with a sort of acoustic arrangement.
What was your relationship with the bluegrass community during that sort of between Hot Rise times? Like, were you? I know you were still playing festivals. I think I saw you on what was Mark O'Connor's show on TV?
Yeah, that was American Music Shop.
Yeah, I saw you with Dave Greer on that. Yeah. Or I saw a YouTube video. Like, you were still in touch with the bluegrass thing.
Well, I didn't ever really leave it, because that was where the circuit was that I knew. And I was drawing on Hot Rise's reputation, probably unfairly, but that's where I could gig. I was booked by the same agent that booked Hot Rise. And conveniently, after a year or so, we started doing some reunion gigs. So I could play, say it, you know, I'd be playing a Telluride on my own, and then Hot Rise would play too, or some other festival, you know, like that. So that, you know, you could double dip, and I still played, you know, I was still playing the same circuit. I was playing folk clubs and bluegrass festivals, really, and folk festivals.
So how does the Daryl Scott thing happen?
Well, Daryl In the period when I was signed to RCA, when I got signed to RCA, I started, even before that, I started traveling to Nashville just to co-write with people, get more songs, and try to make the songwriting success.
You never moved, hey? You stayed in Colorado. You never moved.
Well, for a long time, I didn't. And actually, the RCA people said, you know, you ought to keep doing what you're doing. You don't need to move to Nashville. You could keep playing with Hot Rides. We'll work on this thing.
Yeah.
But I was you know, I was itching to try this new thing on my own, so I quit Hot Rise. And then, anyway, I'd go to Nashville. And then after the RCA thing fizzled, I don't know what year it was, but I got signed to a publishing company, to 4Runner. You know, and knowing, working with Kathy Mattea and her producer, Alan Reynolds, brought me to 4Runner. Alan was the owner of 4Runner, along with Jim Rooney, another great producer and musician, and a couple other partners. And so they signed me, and I got a regular publishing draw. I think they put me with Daryl Scott. They said, this might be a good combination. So I would go to this writing room at his publishing company on Music Row, go down and meet Daryl, and the guy introduces me. He says, play him something that you've written. And even before he sang, he played some licks on it. He said, okay, wow, this guy can play. And then he sang a song, Uncle Lloyd. And I'm like, wow.
And I thought of how their children have children of their own, and how a man at 57 winds up living so long. Won't you wake up, Uncle Lloyd?
That's brilliant. So we wrote a song that day called Daddy's on the Roof Again.
I'm a boy in the bubble, a big fan. I'm a jack that's wild, I'm a Teflon man. I work all day, I come home at night. I'm not all day, but it's all right. Daddy's on the roof again.
And we both liked the song and ended up recording it ourselves in two different ways, you know, on our own records. And so we kept at that. And maybe a couple of years later, I was going to do a tour of the United Kingdom and Ireland.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see if I wanted somebody to come with me, help the driving, you know, duties, and then could split sets. You know, he could play a set, I could play a set, and then maybe we could play together. So that's what happened. And after the first night, we just played everything together. It was like he didn't need to know my material. He could find it and sound good on it, and I didn't need to know his either, but we did know a lot together. Hank Williams was our meeting point.
Yeah, that version of, I'll say this, Dan, I don't care. That version of House of Gold you guys do on that live record is like maybe one of my favorite recordings.
Thank you.
Some people cheat.
Some people cheat.
They steal and lie. For wealth and woe.
For wealth and woe.
Don't they know on Judgment Day all the gold and silver,
all the gold and silver are gonna melt away.
What good is gold?
I can kind of go to it whenever I need to, you know.
Well, you know, it was undeniable that we had a good thing, and it was very lean and mean, and there was nobody in anybody's way. Nobody's holding anybody back. He's so brilliant and so powerful. It was really like riding on a wave.
So he wrote Long Time Gone, that was a huge deal for him, right?
Yeah.
And that's one of those life-changing.
Yeah, get this. We're going to start recording in maybe 3 or 4 days. So I said, well, let's get together. We have some of the songs we know. But, you know, we had played a lot on stage, but we needed new songs to make a new record. So I get to with him the first day. And he said, I found this. And I was looking around the shed. He has this shed, you know, and a big pile of, like, lumber and other junk and cardboard boxes and stuff. And he found this cassette. And he said, and he played me the song that he'd found on the cassette. He says, is this any good? I said, yeah, that's really good. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, long time gone.
So we recorded that. But he also had just finished a song that his dad wrote the lyrics to, Memory Like Mine. And that's, we actually, when I got to the first session, it was at his house. He brought that one out. He says, "You like this?" I said, "Yeah, let's start with that."
Yeah. After, I only talk about this as much as you want to now.
Sure.
So Charles dies.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine how heartbreaking that is.
Yeah. Charles was a quirky guy. He was like triple Virgo. He was very fastidious about everything, very particular about his details, what he wore, how things sounded, what instrument he played, what we played, you know. When he got sick with leukemia, a lot of stuff like that just fell off him. He became this sort of much wiser. He was always a really wise guy, sensitive guy. But he became even more of a mentor. We weren't playing together hardly at all, but we did the Hot Rise reunions. So, yeah, when he died, Daryl and I were on tour in England, and we were in York, I remember. We went to York Cathedral that day and toured the town, and I got the message as we were leaving. It was 99, I think, spring of 99, March or so. It was tragic. I mean, really good close friend, and he really helped me so much. Like when I made Red on Blonde, the Dylan covers.
Big record.
I went to him because he's the guy who really had the collection of the stuff and knew all the records. He's just like a completist. He had everything by, you know, Freddie King, and everything by Bill Monroe, everything by the Stanley Brothers, everything by Bob Dylan. And we just went through the records. I said, "Well, I'm just looking for songs that we can make a good bluegrass version of it." And we got to Senor. I said, "Man," he said, "maybe Senor." I said, "Yeah, let's." So that he really helped with that. But he, you know, to have him not around was a big blow. And but you know, not a day goes by where I don't kind of flash on something that he taught me or said.
I got a couple of questions there, but I'll pivot back to Red on Blonde. Does Bob know about the record? Does he know about Senor? Do you know anything about that?
Well, I do know that he knows about it just because his manager passed off, gave me a reduced rate on the publishing money, 3/4. I recorded 12 of his songs, and they said, "Yeah, well, then you can get, well, you don't pay 75 cents as a normal rate." So that was nice. But then from Al Cooper, his buddy who played on Blonde on Blonde, you know, like a Rolling Stone, he said he was traveling on the bus and they played it. He was just traveling for fun. And they played it on the bus a bunch. So he would have heard it.
You never got to talk to him about it or anything.
But, you know, I don't know if in those days if he traveled on his own bus. I know he does now. I bet he didn't then. I think he knew about it. But I messed up a few lyrics, you know. Prominently on the second track, I messed up the chorus of Tombstone Blues. Otherwise, it's a great track.
Mama's in the factory, she ain't got no shoes. Daddy's in the alley, he's looking for food. And I'm in the kitchen with the Tombstone Blues.
But Dylan's
every record I got's got something like that on it.
Dylan's kind of like Monroe like that, though. Like, he'll test you and he'll...
It's like everything Bill Monroe says or does is a Bill Monroe story, and everything Bob Dylan says or does is a Bob Dylan story. I mean, they're just like those kind of people.
So after Charles dies, it would be, I don't want to say the logical thing, but it would be understandable if after one of the members of a four-person band dies, then the band never gets back together again. But then the band not only reunites, but like is together again. Like Hot Rise becomes a touring working band. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's directly a result of Pete Wernick's agitation about it. You know, his politicking me. We did and I don't know what year it was. We did a reunion. We did them every year, a few. And after Charles, well, when Charles died, we did the gigs that we had booked, the reunion tour we had booked. We did them with Peter Rowan playing a bunch of the shows as a tribute to Charles. And then we got the gig to host the IBMA Awards one year. And Kathy Mateo was the other, the co-host. So Pete called me, I think that maybe the couple days after, or he was still in Nashville, the award show was in Nashville. He said, let's go to lunch. I want to talk to you about something. So he said, you know, we're a band and we can still play. We had done other reunion shows with different guitarists in the meantime. He said, we ought to do more while we can. I said, okay, let's work on it. So we started paying more attention to it and booking more gigs more often. And I don't know when it was, it got to be where we felt like eventually we needed to come up with some new material. Different guitarists would come and go. And at one point we settled on Brian Sutton. He wanted to do it and he was really so qualified and had come up as a kid listening to that stuff and knew what it was about and appreciated it, which was great.
Well, I'm proud to have a family of my own. And I know I need a happy, healthy home. Don't have much, but I'm gonna be alone. If we're hard pressed, we can find a way. Hard pressed, we can find a way.
So, we got started making plans to record again. And so those were the last 4 or 5 years of, you know, the band until a couple of years ago. We made two records. We made a live one. We had our 40th year reunion and made a live record of that. But we had made a studio record before that. So, yeah, that was, you know, it was a good idea to keep it going.
Is that done now? Is Hot Rise?
Yeah, we're done.
It must be interesting for you to see how much Colorado is now so much of bluegrass. You know, like, I mean, you told me at the very beginning, you know, like, yeah, there was a bit of a scene and there was a beginning of a festival which became Rocky Grass. But like the Colorado thing, not only are there like Colorado bluegrass tunes, but like, how do I put this now? Like the Colorado sort of pot festival thing is one of the big money makers in bluegrass music. Like sometimes it feels like there's like two scenes. There's like the bluegrass festival, you know, Doyle Lawson, you know, kind of scene with those kind of lawn chairs in the park and amazing music and all that stuff. Don't get me wrong. And then there's also like the guy smoking dope sitting in the woods in Colorado or places that look like Colorado listening to bluegrass music. You know what I mean? That must be a trip for you given what it was when you first got there.
Yeah, it's you know, Colorado is a place where it's kind of like California. People move there for the, it's a promised land. It's a beautiful place. The weather's great. You meet a lot of like-minded people and open-minded. The music fans are open-minded. So a lot of groups break in Colorado. It's the first place where they start being popular. And the fact that they started this Telluride Bluegrass Festival was kind of a major thing. I happened to know the guy. I mean, I met him after the first, you know, the winter after the first festival, and they booked Ophelia Swing Band. So that was the year they booked Hot Rod. I mean, they booked Newgrass Revival the first time. And I had heard Newgrass, and I was a fan and everything, and it was like an explosion. They made the music available, and all these people said, yeah, we're there. And to me, it was probably pretty small in 1975, but it seemed giant to me. And I don't know. It's Colorado's great for that. But yeah, bluegrass, like Colorado and bluegrass, there is a good scene. Yeah. Fort Collins was a really good scene for traditional bluegrass. And Boulder was okay. Boulder had a more progressive thing. There was, I don't know, just different permutations of it. What's the Folklore Center helped a lot.
What's your relationship with the music now? And what's your relationship with bluegrass like these days?
Well, it's like I'm a part of the big tree. You know, I don't really I don't think I'm outside of it as much as I'm, you know, on the outer edges. I'm not, I mean, I step outside of it, but mostly I'm inside it, but it's such a, so much a bigger tree now.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, like the roots are deeper, you know, you got, you know, Del McCurry kind of, you know, Poe Ramblin' Boy is kind of reinforcing those roots and growing them and outward. And then the branches are like, you know, String Cheese Incident and Leftover Salmon and stuff. And Punch Brothers, you know, Bill Frisell recording with Jerry Douglas and stuff. And just different things like that. And then somebody, Mumford and Sons, kind of like a bluegrass or form thing,
old,
you know.
Old Crow they, kind of thing. There,
yeah, 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 yeah. And it's like old time and bluegrass and folk, what they call Americana. It's all kind of related, but I'm closer to bluegrass. I'm inside. I'm on that tree. I'm not so much on the blues tree or the country tree.
Will you still listen
folk
to
tree.
To Flat and Scruggs? Will you still listen to
Monroe? Oh, yeah.
Like that? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely still go back to that. And really, yeah, that stuff is still, there's so much to it.
Right, because you were in the Earls of Leicester.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was bizarre. I mean, it was fantastic playing with the Earls of Leicester. It was like playing to a record, except you were on the record. It was like so weird. I mean, it seemed so, in some ways, so easy. But I mean, it's like... 35 years of work getting to where it was easy. It was just something I knew. I mean, I couldn't tell you what the tracks are on the record, because to me, it's like we played some Flat and Scruggs songs and they mixed it up and it was out. And yeah, it's, but I had played with Charlie Cushman before that. He was on a lot of gigs with me. And I mean, I was doing stuff with him playing banjo, so I was kind of doing bluegrass kind of music on my own before the Earls of Leicester and him, you know.
Did you?
With Jerry.
Did you know Earl? Did you play with Earl at all?
Just hang around now and again. I met Earl at the IBMA convention one day and shook his hand and shook and said hello to his wife. And apparently as I walked away, she said out loud that somebody was there, heard it, I really like that Walk the Way the Wind Blows that he wrote. And so I heard that and I thought, well, then I was going to make this record called The Crossing.
Yeah, I know that.
And the idea was to get people together that played, you know, people from two sides of the ocean that played traditional music. So Frankie Gavin was a big fiddle hero and acquaintance, so he came up to Nashville and we got Earl in to record with him. They did like a Leather Breeches and Cumberland Gap thing. So I called up Louise, you know, I call up Scruggs' house, I get the number and I call up and Louise answers the phone. I said, Louise, this is Tim O'Brien. She says, hello, Tim. I said, how are you doing? She said, I'm fine. And I said, I'd like to record a song with Earl if he consent to do that. He says, what song? I said, Soldier's Joy or Leather Breeches. She said, just a minute. It's so cut and dried with her. She said, she came back to the phone. She says, Earl can't play a solo on Soldier's Joy, but he can on Leather Breeches, I think she said. Is that what it was? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I said, well, that'd be great. So they came and recorded. Well, before that, I said, well, okay, another thing is I want to invite you to a party. We had a New Year's Day. My ex-wife and I had a New Year's Day party, a picking party a lot of years. And I think that may be in the first or second year of it. And said, I want you to come. And she said, that'd be great. She said, can you fax me the address? As I did. So here comes Earl to this party, you know, and I've got my hippy dippy friends and my, you know, songwriting friends and just friends. And here's Earl Scruggs pulling up and I go and help him bring his banjo in. And that guy, Mike Henderson, I don't know if you know him. He was in Blue Bloods and the original Steel Drivers. he was there. Anyway, so some people were picking, and I said, Earl, I got him something to eat and maybe iced tea or something. I said, let me know if you want me to get your banjo for you. And he said, now would be a good time. So he got his banjo, and he and Henderson and a couple other people started playing, and he played for a couple hours, and then they packed up and went home. And then I got invited to his house. He would have a jam every January around his birthday, usually on the 8th of January. He said, it's a good tune, and it's a good day to have a party.
The 8th of January, that's great.
But, I'd go to his house, and I played on stage with him. I'd go to his house for this picking party, and it'd be like Brother Oswald, Mac Wiseman, Jesse and Jim McReynolds, Marty Stewart. Jeez, I mean, it was like a who's who of bluegrass. And you'd pick and have a little, barbecue. And it was very low key, but, just to be around those guys was amazing. And then when the Chieftains, I got involved playing on a Chieftains record that they made in Nashville.
The Old Bank Road?
Yeah. And then they did some concerts. And they did a date up in Cincinnati with Scruggs as a guest. And it was really funny. I was playing the guitar. I said, Earl, let's do, there's a thing at the end of the Chieftains show, if you ever seen it, they do a long medley. It's like a fiddle tune. And then they turn it, they point to whoever's next and they do whatever they want.
They'll do like Miss McClouds, like the what you guys will call it. What do you guys call Miss McClouds? Have you ever seen The Devil, Uncle Joe or something like that, right? And they'll play that tune. And then in the middle of, they'll just point to Matt Malloy and he'll just play he'll play the Mason's Apron. And then they'll play Miss McClouds.
I know.
It's the greatest.
Like, unbelievable.
It's incredible, right?
So, yeah. So I said, Earl, if you would, when it comes to my point on that last song, let's do If I Should Wander Back Tonight. He said, that'd be fine. So, I said, you think I should play the guitar or the man? She think I should play the guitar. He said, guitar would be good. I said, or should I play the mandolin? He said, mandolin would be good. I said, which one? He said, I don't know. So I don't know what I played. But what was funny was, I remember this. It came time. I think I started it on the mandolin. I probably played mandolin and started it on the mandolin, sang the first verse and chorus. And then I said, pick it, Earl. I got to say, pick it, Earl, just like Lester would say, So that was my only performance, really, with him, probably that one or maybe two. Maybe there was a couple of shows there.
Well, listen, you've been so generous. I wanted to close off sort of in a sort of a broad way, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot, and I thought you might be able to give me a hand with it. So I guess, like, in terms of, let's use Irish music as an example, because that's kind of the world that I
play. Oh, yeah.
That's the kind of music I play, right? So
yeah.
I spent a lot of my life listening to pretty fast, virtuosic fiddle playing and Irish reels and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I had no time for the more contemplative, I mean, a lot of East Clare stuff, right? A lot of the Martin Hayes or Pejo Hayes Patter O'Loughlin, sort of like more contemplative, heartfelt mm-hmm. stuff. And now I'm at this point where, like, that's sort of all I want. Like, all I want is and Steph, who's listening to this and produces this with me, she and I talk about this all the time. Like, all I want is the heart now. Like, I don't want any of the virtuosity. I only want the heart. I think about you that way a little bit when I think about bluegrass music. Is that, like, and I'm not gonna shit talk anybody here, but like, there is a world of bluegrass that maybe I liked more when I was 18 or 19, where it was as fast as you can possibly play and all the time signatures and all the weird ways that you can play this music and really stretch your hands. And I just listened to Nellie Kane before I came in, just to kind of go back to like I wanted to go back to the formation of like how I fell in love with Hot Rise. And I remember hearing Nellie Kane at a jam and just being blown away by it. The point is, I can sort of see you as closer to that heart, that soulness of traditional music, of folk music. I'm not sure if I have a question, but do you know what I mean?
Well, I'm with you on that. I don't know. When I was at that age playing that thing, playing that stuff, I didn't appreciate what you're talking about as much. So if you identify with that, that's a major compliment. It's just coming through anyway. But I really, the older I get, the more that stuff appeals. Talking about Irish music, my stack has got the stuff that gets played. I got this Steve Cooney record of harp pieces, solo guitar with playing harp pieces. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard it.
Yeah, beautiful record.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody else could have done that. Some knowledge. And like I said, you know, I practiced something 35 years and then it was easy to do. Maybe it was easy for Steve to do that, but that stuff is so embedded in him and it comes out that way. The other record that's up is a topic thing, and it's all slow airs played by different people, different instruments. And it's just like, I love that record. And yeah, that stuff, the contemplative stuff, and yeah, it's, I don't know why. Actually, another friend of mine I really respect, Zeke Hutchison, we were talking about Curly Ray Klein. He said, you know, I used to think Curly Ray Klein wasn't that good. He says, now that I'm 50 years old, I can't get enough of that. He said, I was so wrong. I understand it now.
I used to think that Monroe wasn't that good.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. It's hard to, there's a shell, there's a sort of a, it's like your first drink of whiskey. Why would you want to drink that? But then you go, oh, I kind of like I can savor this. And Monroe was, you know, there's a depth there. It just keeps coming. He's kind of like Jerry Garcia because he kind of, there's an X factor that they talk about with Jerry Garcia where he, some days of Dead would just kind of fall flat, you know, but when the X factor was there, nobody could touch him. And Monroe was that way. And when he's on fire, my favorite Monroe record is the live one, Smithsonian one. It's called from by Ralph Rinsler. It's called from many performances, and it's just, he's on fire. It's just beautiful.
Is Bill Keith on that record? Is that one?
I think Bill's on there. It's, you know, it's live shows all over with some different bands. There's a great, the only version I think released of Bill Monroe and Peter Owen singing Walls of Time.
Do you think about this when you make your own music now, like when you sit down with the mandolin or with the bouzouki or the guitar? I guess like what's your approach to bring the heart or the soul or the gras of the music into what you're doing?
Oh man. Well, you know, I think I kind of keep trying to get better. I think I'm better at sort of judging what's essential and what's not, and trying to get to the center of it, the real essence of it, like the way I play, you know, the arrangement or whatever it is I play, I try to make it as simple as possible, but still point to what it is that I like and want in it. The same thing with the way you sing it. And, you know, it's kind of like writing. I've been trying to learn how to write fiction or prose or whatever, but you have to kind of keep chiseling away at it to where I can't really do it right off the bat. You got to sort of keep editing and kind of, you know, going back and starting over. And I've started over enough times on the music. I think I'm better off to from the get go now when I'm coming up with something. So I know it's hard. It's an elusive thing, but you said to have to trust yourself that you know what's real and what's not, and that's really the basic litmus.
Tim, I can't thank you enough for making the time for us today.
Hey, I enjoyed it.
I've been in this prison 20 years or more. Shot my woman with a 44. I'll be right here. It's my dandy. I got 99 years.
Thanks to Tim. What a joy. I mean, that guy can kind of play anything, you know, Irish music and folk music. It was really cool to talk to him a little bit about bluegrass, a little bit about Hot Rise. I still hold out hope for more Hot Rise music.
Toy Heart is produced by Stephanie Coleman and me, Tom Power. Our executive producer is Amy Reitenauer Jacobs, with help, as always, from the entire BGS team. Creative director Shelby Williamson, editor Chris Jacobs, managing editor Justin Hiltner, and all of the writers and contributors that make BGS the best source for Roots Culture Redefined. Discover more at thebluegrasssituation.com. Our theme song, Toy Heart by Bill Monroe, was performed by Chris Eldredge and Kristen Andreasen. Stay tuned for more episodes coming up this season. And if this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with the likes of Jerry Douglas, Alison Brown, Bela Fleck, and Del McCurry. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, share it with a friend who loves bluegrass music. We'll see you soon. Later on.